The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
We have made our start. 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting for 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good evening, listeners. Welcome to a special Monday edition of The Space Show. And I'm your host, David Livingston. Thank you very much for tuning in. We have a show I've been looking forward to for a long, long time. I'm glad we have John Blinkow with us. I'll introduce him in just a minute. First of all, our toll-free number, if you would like to call us, is 1-866-687-7223. So remember, this is a talk show, which usually implies that we talk, so we do prefer you use the toll-free number. So I'll repeat it, 1-866-687-7223. You can still use email, drspace@thespaceshow.com. Plus, you can post comments on our blog, which is thespaceshow.com, all the way to the far right for the upcoming show menu. And then we're the first show listed with John Blinkow. And then scroll down. That's also our blog page. You'll see comments, and you can post your question or comment. And as soon as you hit send or post, I'll get a copy of it and can bring it up on air. And once again, let me remind everybody, you do not, I'll repeat, do not need to be logged in to discuss, to post a comment. You can do it as a guest or a visitor. It's very, very easy to do. If you need any help, send me a quick email to drspace@thespaceshow.com. We're doing a 60-minute format program tonight. So once again, pay attention to the clock. If you want to call John or send us an email, make sure you do it while we're still on air. That always helps, right? And we look forward to your phone calls and your emails and a great discussion with our guest tonight. So a couple of other quick announcements. TheSpaceShow.com is our website. Our brand new website newsletter for the week is posted. You'll see it over on the upper right side. Everything we do is archived, so you can listen as MP3s on our website or quickly download programs or go through podcasting. There is a store if you are interested in Space Show logo wear. To access our store, click on any of the pictures of Pepper listening to The Space Show. Pepper will then guide you to our Cafe Press store, where you will find our collection of Space Show logo wear. There is also a button upper left for Listen Live. So this does tell you how to listen to live archive shows on the website, podcast, and some of the podcast players are embedded on our page there, plus MP3 archives off of our website. We are in TuneIn, iHeartRadio, iTunes. Then for the Apple format, we're in on the Apple podcast app and Overcast. And we are available on the Android format, but because I don't have an Android, I don't know the names of the apps or the way people using Droid work on it. I think it's a little different than on an iPhone. But if you do have any questions, go ahead and email me, drspace@thespaceshow.com, and I'll do my best to get answers for you. One of the key things to remember is the Space Show is a nonprofit 501c3 with one, O-N-E, GiantLeapFoundation.org, and we're listener-supported. That means that you, the listener, keep us on the air and support us with your financial contributions. So there is a PayPal link, center right, upper right, on our page for electronic contributions to The Space Show. That link also tells you how to send a check to OneGiantLeapFoundation.org if you'd rather make a contribution via a check in the U.S. mail. If you have any questions, again, email me, drspace@thespaceshow.com. Our parent nonprofit, 501c3, is OneGiantLeapFoundation.org. Check it out. You can also find out about being a member of our advisory board. And if you have questions or want more information, email me. Once again, drspace@thespaceshow.com. Do remember we're in the second part of the year, and we're drawing down funds that we raised late last year during our annual fundraising campaign. And we're now getting ready to start the fundraising for the end of this year. So as I put out a call a couple of days ago on another show, if you are a nonprofit fundraiser and you have ideas, suggestions, experience, or things that you think would help us, I'd like to hear from you. You know how to reach me, and we're open to your input and your ideas. And as well, if you are experienced or know about setting up GoFundMe pages, this one would be for space education and expertise and knowledge. I'd like to hear from you as well. So you know how to reach us, drspace@thespaceshow.com. So as I said, John Blinkow is with us tonight, and he is the CEO of the Gateway Foundation, not to be confused in any way with NASA's Lunar Gateway project. So let's make sure you don't mix those up. He has worked as a pilot for 24 years, flying all over the world in aircraft such as the 757, DC-10, 747-400. His experience as a pilot instructor includes United Airlines, Boeing Flight Safety, and as a security instructor for the wonderful TSA. John graduated with a BA from Cal State San Bernardino in 1996. And he is going to introduce us to the Gateway Foundation, the Von Braun Space Station, how they're doing it, what they're doing it, and we want to hear from you during this program, 1-866-687-7223. John, welcome to the Space Show, fresh out of your visit in Seattle at the Space Settlement Conference. Good to hear from you, and thank you for being with us tonight.
Thank you for having me, David.
Listeners, they have a website. You might want to look at it while we're talking. It is gatewayspaceport, all one word, .com. Introduce us to the Gateway Foundation. What's it all about? What are you doing? What are your goals, objectives? Give us sort of the 101, okay?
Well, the Gateway Foundation was formed back in 2012. I was flying jets at that time. And I remember it was kind of funny. I look at this picture of an old space station. I think it was the one from 2001. And I asked myself, how come we haven't done this? You know, why haven't we got spaceports right now? And I started to realize that, you know, NASA, who we all expected to do this, is never going to do this. It's got to be us. And so I started thinking about, you know, is it possible to do something like this? And I did some investigations, and I realized, you know, the technology is here. We have the tech to build spaceports. You know, do we have the will? Have we lost something along the way? So I started the Gateway Foundation with the intention of building the first spaceport, and that's the Gateway Spaceport.
So help me get clear, so I can be clear for the listeners. You're talking about building the Gateway Spaceport, but what about building an orbital space hotel? Are we talking two different things? You're talking about a space station, the Von Braun Space Station. Is it all under the umbrella of a spaceport, or are they different items or objects?
They're different projects, yes.
Okay.
The Gateway Spaceport is our goal, because we know that once one is built, there's going to be many to follow. The model will work out to show the people that these can be built and they're economically feasible. But the problem is, you have to develop a space construction industry in order to build anything in space, and we don't have one. NASA built the International Space Station with just a couple tools, the arm, and then they added on a robot that kind of goes on the arm, which they call the hand of the arm, that's Dexter, and the suited astronaut, and that was really it. That's not a space construction industry. Those are just tools to kind of get you by for a while. We're forming a space construction company right now, Orbital Assembly. And the job of Orbital Assembly is to become the first space construction company to build, you know, almost anything in space. and we're collecting tools, and we're you know, meeting with other organizations who can help us build these tools and bring the tools together to start building things in space. Now, one of the problems we had was you don't need space construction tools or a space construction company if there's nothing to build. You need a project. You need something out there to get the thing, get all started. And one of the things we were looking at was what would be a good first project. And one of those first projects was an orbital telescope. We called it Project Copernicus. It was going to be a 30-meter orbiting telescope. But the thing we didn't like about Copernicus was the mirrors take so long to make. I mean, it's years just to bake them. That's specially made by Ball Aerospace. And then you have to grind them down, and then you have to polish them. And it's just a long process. And we thought, you know, we want something that can come together quicker and also something that would be bigger to help us utilize all the tools that we need to build spaceports, namely the GSAL, which stands for Gateway Segment Assembly Line. This is a device that builds components in segments. And what it does is you load into one end the structural members, and it welds them all together inside of itself, and then out comes the other end, a segment, and you keep making these segments until you have a spaceport. Well, we didn't want to start off building a spaceport as our first space construction project. We wanted something smaller, like the telescope, but along the same lines of a spaceport, and that's where we came up with the idea of the Von Braun Rotating Space Station.
Okay, so you have a spaceport and a space station, and where's the hotel?
Well, the Von Braun can be a hotel. It's going to have hotels in it. Here's the DNA of Von Braun Station. When we first started looking at building it, we started thinking immediately, you know, what's the best economic model to build this? Because we knew we had the tech to do it. But what's the best way to pay for this thing? Well, one of the easy ways is just to bring in a bunch of partners. And we were thinking of the space agencies like NASA or ESA or JAXA. We thought they might want to have a laboratory on board. So we started looking at the model of having a bunch of national laboratories and then also corporate partners who wanted to also move into the new realm of space, of being an investment area. So hotels, of course, would be one of them. Hilton, Marriott, and many others, too, want to, you know, possibly have a hotel there also. And then we also look at corporate ideas. Well, what about Virgin Galactic? They want to be the first space line. What if they wanted to have a presence in space also? So we started looking at all these people and saying, we could kind of carve up into a pie what Von Braun Station is and reduce our initial upfront costs by bringing in these so-called partners. Now, that was the model that you see when you go to the website, the Gateway Spaceport website. You'll see the Von Braun project, and you'll see lots of different entities there. You'll see NASA modules. You'll see JAXA modules and so forth. That is not actually the most lucrative manner of doing of building a space station like Von Braun Station. If you built Von Braun Station with just hotel modules, like let's say 12 of them, the rest of them are service modules and so forth, then you have a highly profitable station in space that could generate enormous amounts of money rather quickly. And the cost to build this station is actually not as bad as a lot of people think. A lot of people think in terms of ISS, which is about $150 billion. But our initial estimates came up with something about half that price to build Von Braun Station, which has 70 times more interior volume. And the reason is because we're going to build it using a lot of components that are the same. The modules are all the same. The couplings are the same. The access tubes are the same. And then we also, of course, have lower launch costs, too. NASA had to build ISS using the shuttle, which is exorbitantly expensive. We're counting on new rockets coming online. They're going to be a lot cheaper, like SpaceX Starship or Blue Origin's new Glenn or new Armstrong. So the economic model for building Von Braun Station is actually the most compelling reason to build it.
You've already got a caller on hold who's been waiting, so well, I don't think we're through with the introduction yet, but I'm going to go ahead and bring in the caller. I don't know who it is. He's not showing up on caller ID. But hi, caller. Welcome to the show. Who are you? Where are you? Thank you very much for calling.
Hi, David. This is John. I usually call from Fremont, but I'm in Salt Lake City.
Okay.
And, John, met at the SSI. I asked you a question there, and I actually also posted the question on the blog for you.
You're John Fowler.
I'm John Josie. Is the name.
Oh, John Josie. I'm sorry.
No problem.
John Fowler. I thought it was you. Okay.
Yeah, but thank you for answering my questions, and I direct listeners to the blog. There were a couple of questions on there, and I was asking John about the finances for the station. And on the Gateway website, you mentioned a lottery, and I asked you about the target audience for that, and trying to get an idea of, you know, what sort of, you know, demand for this would, you know, pay for it. And so I asked, you know, if the target audience would be space enthusiasts or the general public, and you mentioned that it would be mainly people that would pay for a lottery, but also be space enthusiasts, right?
Yes, exactly. So, let me go ahead and expand on this for you to give you an idea of what I'm talking about there in case my answer wasn't exactly what you're looking for or easy to understand. Lotteries are played by people who are looking at one thing. It's that number in the window. They want to imagine themselves winning all this money and solving all their problems in life. Well, that's the reason that a lottery is actually a good vehicle to build something like a spaceport. Because lotteries always have a benefactor. They always have something that they're sending their money to. In the state of California, it's schools. In the state of Colorado, their forests are kind of supplemented by the lottery, too. So what you do is you set up a lottery that is sending money basically to the construction of a spaceport. Now, the people who are going to play the lottery are just the same people that play lotteries anywhere, whether it be Super Lotto or any other lottery out there. They're looking for that number in the window, and they would play this lottery for the same reason. But there's going to be another kind of player. So you're talking about an additional contingent of players, and those are space enthusiasts like ourselves. They, too, like haven't you all your life wanted to be able to contribute to NASA and not so much to maybe other programs like Social Security or the defense or something like that? This would be your opportunity to contribute to that. But also, coming back to you is a chance to go into space. Because when you have thousands of people going to space every month like you would at a spaceport, your chances have gone through the roof versus just trying to win a lottery or something. Now your chances are, well, lottery odds, right? 290 million to one.
Okay. So it sounds good, but I'm a space enthusiast, and I'm not necessarily someone who plays the lottery. So, you know, if you look at the Venn diagram of people who play lotteries and space enthusiasts, you got to have a lot of space enthusiasts.
Well, no, we're not counting on the space enthusiasts. That's the whole idea. We're counting on those people who play lotteries because they see that number in the window. It's just another lottery to them. Whether it says Gateway Lottery or whether it says Super Lotto, when that number starts climbing, they all start buying tickets there. Same mechanisms, too. $2 per ticket, you know, long odds and so forth. But the money goes towards building a spaceport. So we're not counting on space enthusiasts for funding the entire thing. That's just a small contingent. But they're the big benefactors on the end. Now, the Gateway Lottery wouldn't just build a spaceport. It would actually function to fund a lot of things in the space industry. Even suborbital flights would be getting money from them. Because, as you know, lotteries don't just have the big prize. They also have smaller prizes along the line if you get, you know, so many numbers correct, like 5 out of 6 or something. Those prizes would go to other aspects of the space construction or the space industry. So you're funding a lot of things. Even we imagine an academy would also be built using lottery funds so that people who are lower income could move into the space industry.
Are you winning cash, too?
Yes, you are.
So
that's the main contingent of the lottery. It functions just like a normal lottery would. It's just that once a month you're going to have a trip prize also. And this is when the people who are really into lotteries for the money and so forth may not play. And that's fine. The trip prize is for the people who are like us, the people who believe in space travel and want to have it happen. And now your chances of winning go actually up a little bit because the lottery odds are a little different for the trip prize. It's not the 290 million to one. It's a lot less than that.
So, John, let me step on the other John for a minute. When I started the space show and space tourism still sort of had a giggle factor, but that was rapidly, I think, going away. But But there were a number of people that wanted to finance space tourism through space lotteries.
Uh-huh.
So my memory's not real clear. We're going back to 2001, 2002, 2003. There was a group in Texas that put together a space lottery. It was illegal. They got busted for it, and I think there were criminal penalties. Now, I don't remember all of the details. I used to have a guy come on the show who was doing a space tourism lottery, Tony Webb. He was on in the 2003 range. I have no idea where he is or what happened to him. And he wanted to do a lottery, and every time he turned around, it was illegal. He could not pull off doing a private lottery. Now, I don't...
It's still illegal.
So what is different today? Why can you do a lottery and these other groups 15, 18, 20 years ago could not do one?
We're not going to start a lottery until it is legal. Now, here's how that works. 24 states in the Union of America have a process called the ballot initiative where voters can vote in new laws to do things that they want, that they find important, such as marijuana, gay rights. There's a long list of things that voters have voted in.
Absolutely.
In particular states. Now, not all the states have this mechanism, but California and Colorado and Texas and the other ones do, and I think Florida does also. What happens here is, you convince the people of that state, which actually wouldn't be too hard, to run a lottery just to build a spaceport. Now, the proceeds of any state that's going to run that lottery gets taxes, so they're going to benefit right away. But it's the people that become the biggest benefactors. They have a lottery that can give them a chance to go into space. In a state like California or Texas and a couple others, which are, you know, space industry states, they're going to see contracts coming down to build this spaceport. So they benefit in two ways. Now, the way the ballot initiative works is, and this is the hardest part, you have to get first 600,000 signatures to get a law on the ballot, and that takes money. That's millions of dollars. We talked to a guy named Michael Rhodes from Silver Bullet. He does this professionally, and he was saying it's going to be about $7 to $10 million to get your idea on the ballot. So this is something that's going to come down the line. It can't come right away. But there is another way to do this. You can do it outside the country. Of course, Americans wouldn't be able to play, but there are countries that are much easier to get things done, like Singapore or Abu Dhabi or Ireland. They may take something up like this because they would want the lottery to be based in their country and the tax proceeds going to them. So what we're looking at right now is, do we want to start in the United States? Do we want to start it outside the United States? And as it gains influence, move it into the United States when we have more money to do this ballot initiative. We're going to focus on something else right now, and that is the formation of a space construction industry. Because lottery or no lottery, if we haven't got a space construction industry, we're not going to build anything. So we formed Orbital Assembly, the first space construction company, and that's what we're working on right now. And when we have the money, we'll start throwing cash around to start the lottery, because it's the goose that lays the golden eggs.
How do you fund Orbital Assembly?
We're going to form Orbital Assembly the traditional manner. We're going to look for investors, and we're going to sell stock.
Okay.
Yeah.
How much do you need for Orbital Assembly?
Well, the first thing we're going to do is we're going to start working on the primary space construction machine that we need to build large structures in space. And that is it's a derivative of the G-cell I was talking about earlier. It's a mechanism which builds trusses very fast. We've kind of renamed it the VBTAL, the Von Braun Truss Assembly Line. And I'm sorry?
I'm just laughing at your use of Von Braun for all of this, but go ahead.
It's named after the station that's going to build.
No, right, I understand that.
It has a large truss on it, and this machine is designed just to build that truss. So we're calling it the Von Braun Truss Assembly Line to build that truss. So that's the idea, and that's the first thing we're going to do, and we're going to start working on a prototype literally this month. That's what we're looking for funding right now.
Okay, John from Fremont, I'm sorry I stepped on your phone call, so go ahead. You're back with the microphone.
Yeah, I just have one more question. Very, very interesting discussion, and it's really, really an exciting concept.
Thank you.
So I saw an article on your website by your senior architect, the senior design architect, Tim Alatorre.
Tim Alatorre,
yeah. And he was being interviewed for a publication called D-Zine. uh-huh. I think is the name of it. And he mentioned that the timeline for the Von Braun station is by 2025. Is that still an accurate timeline?
It is. And here's why. The hardest thing about building Von Braun Station is going to be forming a space construction industry. When you look at the components, and we've made entire videos about how each of the systems and the systems architecture are all going to work together and so forth. Each of the components are actually rather simple. Things that we've done before, the structure is actually rather, the frame is actually rather simple. The modules are probably the toughest thing because they're going to be rather large, but they're still just aluminum lithium. It's like building an aircraft hull. The couplings, the access tubes, all really simple stuff. The Dream Chasers you see lining the outside of the station, that once again is chosen because it's an off-the-shelf thing that we can buy, that we don't have to develop. So the timelines for building all these components and actually putting it together is actually rather short. It's the development of the tools that we have to get on right now, and that's why Orbital Assembly has been formed and is right now getting funds to build this first prototype of the VBTOL.
Okay. Well, hey, thanks, John. Really interesting discussion. I'll get off and let someone else call in.
Thank you very much.
Nice talking to you, John.
Thanks, John.
Okay.
Listeners, Fremont John has cleared the line. It is 1-866-687-7223. You have another email waiting for you, Popular Man. So this is from Theron, T-H-E-R-O-N, in case I always get his name wrong, Lutz, L-U-T-Z. I am a fan of your Von Braun and Gateway Station concepts. I understand that you are going balance the station with tanks and fluid channels throughout the station. My question is, how are you going to balance the station with a large vessel attached, such as the SpaceX Starship, which you show in your concept video? Have you considered a stationary central hub for docking large ships to help with stabilization? I admit engineering on that may be a little difficult to achieve. Could the modules for this be launched with a Falcon or Falcon Heavy, and how many launches do you think this will take? Or is it fairing size too small? Is the fairing size too small for the modules? Thank you for your time.
Really good questions, Theron. Let's start with the balanced tank system. One of the systems on board Von Braun Station is a series of tanks under the floors of the modules. And these tanks are going to be about half full of water, or maybe even a third full of water. And the idea is we move water around to balance out any oscillations that occur whenever you have lots of people moving one side of the station or another, or you're moving loads to one side of the station or another and so forth. We don't really see that the imbalance as being too much of a problem, really, because the station is weighing about 2.5 million pounds, or actually more than that. Anyway, it's a lot. It's very heavy. Whereas people moving around is just not that big of an imbalance in weight and so forth. Now, as to the docking mechanism, this is something we agonized over. This is the most complex part of the station. We initially wanted to have the station not have any despun sections for docking. That would require that the ships coming into dock with the station would have to gain rotation to match the rotation of the station. But we realized, and this is something that Dr. Spilker pointed out, ships that are long and tubular in shape, which most of them would be, especially Starship, they can have a tendency to tumble if there's even the slightest imbalance in their design as they start to rotate. And we didn't feel that it would be practical to have every ship that's going to dock with the station have or systems on board to maintain balance and rotation. We thought it would be easier for us to despin a section of the station. So if you look at the videos of Von Braun Station in action and you watch closely, the station will remain in rotation, but the arms, the docking arms, will slowly be despun to dock with the starships as they're coming in. The starship will dock straight in, not in rotation, and then after the arms grip the starship, they'll start to rotate the starship up to match the rotation of the station. So you're right. We don't have a despun section, but we do have despun arms that spin down for docking and spin back up after they dock with a starship. So that's how that works. And what was the other questions after that?
Let's see. He talked about the balance tanks. Let's see. Have you considered a central hub for docking large ships to help with stabilization? And then he says, could the modules be launched with the Falcon or Falcon Heavy, and how many launches would it take?
Good question, yes. The modules are bigger in diameter than the Starship, or bigger than even the Super Heavy booster also. But if you look at most rockets, they'll have a fairing that's 1.3 times core diameter, and that's exactly the equation that we used to determine the maximum diameter of our modules. So when we put a module on top of a modified Starship designed to accept that module, that's the equation that we use. So it's actually going to work out in the same manner. We're going to put a module right on top of a modified Starship, which means a truncated Starship. There's no upper portion. We're using the Starship as what they call an upper stage to deliver the module to the construction site. So that's how that works.
Theron, if you have more questions, if that didn't answer all of what you wanted, please send us another email or give us a try to give us a call. I know you expressed some possible phone problems, but what the heck, give it a try. We have Carly in Denver, Colorado, with a question for you. And she says, I have not yet been to your website, and I'm not familiar with your project. I was not at the SSI conference. Where is this supposed to be orbiting? Where are you going to put it, so to speak? And in terms of the hotel or the occupancy of the structure, how many people will be there, and how many crew versus people having a good time?
Really good question, Carly. Let's see. The orbit is actually a particular orbit. Most of the times we're looking at something like an equatorial orbit or maybe 30 degrees above the equatorial. We have chosen a sun-synchronous orbit, which is a polar orbit. This puts us in sunlight all the time. We chose this orbit on purpose because we wanted to have power coming to the station 24/7. So as it rotates the Earth in constant sunlight, you don't really need so many batteries as backup because you have all this power coming to the solar panels. There are actually 29 microgrids on the station. Each of them are able to back up other parts of the station if one of them happens to go down. And what was the question after that?
Crew size, participant, tourist size, passenger size,
Well, it depends on the economic model that we use for the station. I described two of them, one where we're sharing parts of the station with national laboratories and then having a few hotels also. And I also talked about an all-hotel configuration. This, I think, actually might be the best way to go. This might be the best way to attract investors because the returns are very fast and they're very, very large. In that configuration, we'd be looking at 288 guests at a time and 112 crew for a total of 400 people. The maximum size of the station, the maximum occupancy, is determined by the number of people you can get off the station in an emergency, the same equation that's used for cruise ships. You have to basically be able to get everyone off the cruise ship in an emergency. So it came down to how many ERVs, emergency return vehicles, could we post around the station, and that was 44. So if we had 10 people per ERV, that's 400 people, and then we have four spares also in case something went wrong. So that was the big determining factor on the size of the crew and the size of the station.
This is in LEO?
Yes, it is. And one more thing about our particular orbit. The station won't be alone very long. There's going to be a community building up around it of fuel depots, maintenance facilities, and service facilities and so forth, and probably other laboratories in zero-G. We've even talked about bringing up a module 25, because there's 24 modules, a 25th module that wouldn't actually connect to the station that would allow people just to go over there and experience zero-G if they wanted to.
So these would be your modules coming up for depots or independent third-party people wanting to be near your station?
They would probably be independent parties. Actually, we'd want a community to develop outside of our own funding mechanism. So I could see energy companies, putting fuel depots up there. I could see other entities come up there, even other countries with their own laboratories and so forth nearby, to allow their crews to have a place to go to have a good meal at night or something, or maybe to sleep at the station for a while and get some exercise under some G's. And the station, by the way, I should mention this because a lot of people don't know, we're not trying to pull 1G of gravity here. This is a low-gravity station. It's designed to spin at 1.5 RPM. And at a 620-foot diameter, that's going to give you lunar gravity at that rotational rate. And that's what we want. We want to do low-gravity research on people.
So this would be as if you're on the moon. And of course, we don't know whether 1/6 gravity is a good gravity prescription for humans or not. That's still
sort of an unknown
question.
That's exactly why we want to do that. The crew would be guinea pigs living there for 6 months at a time. And we'd, you know, the guests are only showing up there for, you know, half a week or for a week or so forth. But the crew is going to be there 6 months at a time. And any national laboratories who had that presence there would have an opportunity to study how well the crew did under low gravity for long periods of time. Later on, we would increase the rotation of the station up to Mars gravity, and that would allow, once again, the national laboratories and space agencies to study how well people do long-term in 1/3 of a G, or actually 0.38 for Mars.
So how do you increase the spin? What are your energy sources or your powers because you're in a polar orbit?
Well, yeah, we have power, but also, you know, every time the people are coming up, if we need fuel to spin up or spin down or increase the spin, the rotational rate, they're going to be bringing fuel for those engines. On the outer diameter of the station, there are two RCTs, and these are basically rocket engines which can increase the spin if we want, which we would do to go to Mars gravity, or even to stop the whole station if we ever wanted to also.
What's your completion date for all of this? Obviously, 2025 is not going to be your total end-of-the-line completion date, right?
2025 is the date that we want to start the whole thing. And this can actually come together rather quickly. If you've studied our construction techniques and methods and the machines that we're going to be using, it wouldn't take that long. And remember, when you have something like Starship, you can get supplies every week. It's not like the old NASA days where a shuttle would show up every 3 months and hand you another module. No, it's affordable to where you can have Starship show up with more tools and more equipment and more crews rather quickly. And this is really important. Remember, this is not a NASA project. This is a revenue-generating station, so you have to get it built quickly so you can start building revenue so that your investors can get their money back.
So what would be, if assuming you can keep to a fairly good timeline, what would be your completion date?
We should easily complete it within 2 years, 2027.
Wow.
Yes, easily.
So we're not even going to be back on the moon by then?
I don't know.
Most likely.
There's a lot of conjecture on that one, and I'll steer clear of that.
Do you have any support or opposition or challenges from government, from NASA, or are they out of the picture?
We haven't really consulted them yet. This is strictly right now a private enterprise. But we see NASA coming into the picture. I mean, there's a lot of NASA people who I've talked to about the idea, and they're very excited about it. Because NASA people are just like you and I, David. They want to go into space in their lifetime. And that's really why I got into this. I, too, want to go. You want to go. Everyone in the space community, we want our chance to go. This is our best chance of going into space. Because now, instead of paying $35 million that the last guy did to go to ISS, and I think now they're charging over $50, we could have, you know, a 3.5-day stay down to $5 million. And there are even smaller rooms on the station which could go for $3 million, or even the smallest one, $2 million for a 3.5-day stay. And there's lots of models that we can look at, too, to adjusting that rate to get maximum occupancy.
So are these single rooms, double rooms, bunk bed rooms? How are you envisioning the accommodations?
They're actually large rooms. The way we have it set up right now, the model that we're looking at for generating income is based around the idea of having three types of rooms. The most expensive is the luxury suite. And that would be $5 million, but it's big. It's 126 square meters. The next one down is a luxury room, and that's about 62 square meters. And then the smallest room is about 30 meters. And that would be about $3 million for the first day on that one.
So there's no private room, so to speak.
Oh, these are private rooms.
Oh, they're private rooms.
You've got a door, a bed, a bathroom, the whole thing. It's like staying in a hotel. That's the whole idea. We want people to have that hotel experience. Because when you look at the model that worked for ISS, people paying a lot of money for actually what is not a very good stay there. They were eating food out of cans. They were sleeping in sleeping bags next to snoring Russian astronauts. There was no shower, you know. There's no privacy. And, you know, it just wasn't a very pleasant stay. But it wasn't supposed to be. It's a laboratory, right?
Right.
This is not to be a laboratory for the most part where the hotels are. And, of course, there'll be state laboratories, which are laboratories. But the thing is, the station's design is for the comfort of the people, and that's the attraction. You can have that hotel experience, and go into space. Now, we also have another program we're looking at, for not just for the space tourists. We're looking for people who also want to be what we call citizen astronauts. And that's kind of an expanded stay and with more amenities and so forth, where you wouldn't just go for a little spacewalk out on the ORT, which we'd, you know, offer to our guests, but you'd also have an opportunity to, you know, maybe work with the crew on certain things. And the crew is kind of looking at you too, like, you know, maybe someday you're going to be working up here with us. So there's lots of options when you do something this large.
Barbara is in Phoenix, and she says, if I'm listening correctly, you've mentioned the possibility for different hotels for different modules. So here on Earth, we obviously have motels and hotels at all sorts of price and accommodation and luxury or standard schedule, like a Days Inn, for example, or a Holiday Inn, or something much more luxurious. Do you foresee discount hotel rooms there as well as more luxury, say, Hilton or some of the other larger name hotels? Would there be a cheaper Days Inn opportunity, for example?
Or Motel 6.
Yeah, or Motel 6. She didn't say Motel 6, but yeah, or a Motel 6. That would work.
The driving force behind the design of Von Braun Station is to get it as cheap as possible. Now, if you recall in your history, there was the first Boeing jet that they ever put out called the 707. The 707 wasn't built for middle-class people. It was designed for what we call the jet set. They were the movie stars. They were the millionaires flying around. Everybody, it was very glamorous and so forth.
Right.
That's what Von Braun Station is going to be for. Not because we want it to, because we have to have it that way. It's the only economic model that will work for building something like this. But what Von Braun is going to do is it's going to show investors, and we're going for traditional investment here, it's going to show investors that money can be made doing something like this, and it can actually be made rather quickly, depending on the economic setup that we have. And the whole idea is Von Braun can be paid off quickly, and the next one can be built, and the next one, and bigger ones can be built. Now, here's the key to making Von Braun affordable for middle-class people: paying off Von Braun quickly. Once it's paid off, you can drop the price now significantly. And once you have other stations going that are going to be newer and bigger, you know, they're probably going to cost about the same or so forth, Von Braun's price can drop down significantly to where middle-class people can afford to go to Von Braun Station. Just like the old 707. When the 737s came along and the 747 came along, if you were going to fly someplace on a 707, you weren't paying the top price anymore. You're paying a much lower price. That's the whole key to Von Braun Station. It's going to be affordable in the future. It's just not going to be affordable for most people right at the start.
Interesting. And I'm assuming you'll be marketing for international users as well as users here in America, correct?
Oh, yeah. It'll be a very international crowd.
When you talk to people who are space industry people, engineers, scientists, even human factors people. I know there were human factors people like Dr. Jim Logan, for example, at the SSI conference. How is your concept and your program received? And I'm curious as to the sort of professional peer review type of feedback that you get.
We've been getting really good reviews. And the reason is when people look at it, I mean, initially when you look at, you see this big station, and you think in terms of ISS dollars, oh, it's going to cost $500 billion, but it's not. The economic evaluation that we did by one of our team, Jeff Greenblatt, he's a professional doing this, he's saying, no, using traditional manufacturing models, this station is going to cost less than $70 billion. And that's half the price of ISS. But if you're using new advanced manufacturing tools like additive manufacturing, it can go as low as $50 or $55 billion. And one of the reasons this is so affordable is because the station is not that sophisticated. We're using all off-the-shelf equipment and hardware. It's a simple design, really. There are much more complex designs that I saw at ISSI, and they are the future of what space construction is going to be working on, larger habitats, permanent habitats, and so forth. The Von Braun Station, in terms of what's coming, and I mean in our lifetime, within 15, 20 years, it's going to be small. It's going to be simple. And that's the whole idea. We want it to be affordable.
Got another email. Listeners, you can also call us. There's still plenty of time to do that. 1-866-687-7223. Roger is in Oklahoma City. And Roger says, we all know that the most popular question asked astronauts when they go to speak to people is, how do you go to the bathroom in space? We also have all seen pictures from the ISS of what their shower system is like, and we've heard lectures and seen pictures and training on the space toilet. If you're putting regular people up there, then number one, how do they eat? There's also been a lot of programming and videos on how NASA arranges food, compartmentalizes it, and the kinds of food that they can get. So how are you going to do these typical hotel features, bathroom, showers, sleeping, food, and eating, when, as you said earlier, it's not the most luxurious experience on the space station?
Really good question, Roger, and I'm glad you asked that. First of all, let's talk about the bathroom, and let's not talk about the bathroom on board ISS. It's kind of a nightmare. The bathrooms on Von Braun Station are going to be traditional. It's going to be basically no different than you would see when you go into a regular hotel. Now, there are new advanced toilets that are being utilized that produce less waste and so forth, or handle their own waste. We might look at those, but your experience when you sit down is going to be no different, and we want that hotel experience. I mean, we would not want our guests to feel in any way, you know, shape, or form, the ickiness you can when you're at ISS, including their shower experience and their eating experience. I think they gave up the shower and they're just kind of done a sponge bathing, but I'm not sure about that. I remember seeing a prototype shower that looked kind of like a nightmare or something out of a torture chamber. The shower on board Von Braun Station is going to be a traditional shower, except at the idea that we're thinking of having the shower double as a vacuum shelter. So it's going to be a rather large volume shower. But if there was a puncture in your module and you were depressurizing, one of the things you would do is you'd run to the shower in the smaller rooms. In the larger suites, you may have a whole bathroom that's built as a pressure, as a vacuum shelter. You would run into the shower and shut the door behind you. And in the drawers in the shower, which are waterproof, you would have a vacuum suit that you'd crawl into. So in that aspect, the shower is not necessarily traditional, but while you're taking a shower, it would function very much like a traditional shower would here on the ground at a very nice hotel. Now, the eating experience is going to be one of the best parts. We're going to hire chefs from all over the world, the best chefs, because when you pay this kind of money to go to a station, you're not going to get standard food. You're going to get the best food. So the crew and the guests are all going to eat rather well on the station.
But what are they going to eat? They're going to eat terrestrial food?
Yes, exactly. You're going to have steak and lobster. You're going to have whatever you want, really. I mean, you're going to have, you know, foods from all over the world, too. So it's going to be the best foods from France.
Well, but you've got 1/6 gravity. You're going to be able to digest this food and process. What's it going to do? I don't know. Is there any experimental data on eating a terrestrial diet in a microgravity situation in space? Do we have any information about that?
I remember reading years ago when I started this research on this that there was some doctors saying that digestion is a bit of a problem on board ISS because there's no gravity. But you're having a little bit of gravity on Von Braun Station, and this is going to be an experiment. We're going to see how well people digest. But I have a feeling it's probably going to go okay because you have gravity to pull that down. It's probably going to have to do more with the amount of fluids that you have to help, you know, keep things moving inside your body. So I don't think that's going to be a problem, but, you know, I mean, if it was a problem at lunar gravity, okay, we'll increase the rotation of Mars gravity, and we'll see how people do it at 0.38.
And you're going to be able to cook with flames or fire? Or?
No flames. No.
So how are you cooking?
You're cooking, within a restaurant with non-flame. You'd have electric grills and things like that.
Wow. If you pull this off, it's going to be really something.
You know, I'm glad you said that because you have to remember, it's not whether we're going to pull this off, it's when. This is inevitable. Humankind's expansion in our solar system is something that's just going to happen. We have cheaper and cheaper vehicles with higher lift capabilities coming online very soon. Von Braun Station is inevitable. It's going to happen. And the biggest reason is probably not the one that you think of. Everyone thinks in terms of technical restrictions. It's not. It's economic. It's when the investors look at the economic models for Von Braun Station and they say, yeah, we can make our money back rather quickly. This can be built rather quickly. That's going to be the compelling reason. That's when we're all going to know it's time. And that time, the age of spaceports, is going to happen in our time. It's going to happen rather quickly. you're going to see SpaceX making more money off of space construction than any other endeavor that they have, whether taking people to the moon or to Mars or anything, because it's an easy trip. It's a short trip. It's 8 hours up and down. It's low energy coming back. You haven't got that high speed like when you come back to the moon or from Mars. It's going to be easy return. It's easy on the vehicles. It's going to be their cash cow.
So you're going to take a whole bunch of people up there. I don't know what your screening is going to be. Doesn't look like the AST office has a lot of really particular demanding screening stuff other than disclosure. I've not seen a form. Maybe getting a scuba diving certificate had, you know, more requirements than going into space will have. I don't know. But what are you going to do for clinics for people that get sick? I don't mean just space sick, but you know, people that have medical conditions, and some internist or GP someplace said, yeah, sure, go, you're okay. And you know, and then, and then you go and you find out you got real problems. And are you going to get them back to Earth? Are you going to have facilities to try to treat them? Can you resuscitate someone? Can you give them oxygen? What are you doing for emergencies? You can't call 911.
We could call. I'm not sure they could do anything. Good question, Dave. No, really, we're going to have a couple of doctors on board. We're going to have a clinic, too, probably with a full surgical suite, you know, a group of nurses, too, and assistants trained in surgery. But remember, if things are really bad, if that person, you know, needs to go down for an operation, then we'll put on board a Dream Chaser and send it down. That's what they're there for. They're there to, you know, get people out safely if we need to. But remember that the pre-screening is going to eliminate a lot of this.
So you are going to pre-screen.
Oh yeah, not everyone can go. You got a 3G takeoff. You know, you got a couple of, you know, about 1.5 G's coming down. You're going to have to be in good shape to go to Von Braun Station. And part of the program is going to be, you know, when you show interest, when you put a deposit down, you're going to be talking with other people and you say, okay, it's time to get yourself in shape. You're going to get the best shape of your life. So, you know, start walking. You know, start lifting weights and start eating better and so forth. Because space travel is never going to be easy. You're going to have to get in shape to do this.
Yeah, I would think you are. That's going to be interesting. Also, airlines have not really done this yet, although I don't understand why they don't.
For the crew, they do.
Well, no, what I'm going to say is that I have had the unhappy experience more times than I would like in sharing my seat with someone who takes up a seat in two-thirds. And, of course, they have a mass that means that they're taking up more fuel to ship their body from San Francisco to New York than I'm taking up to do this. And yet they're paying the same price for the seat as I'm paying, which I don't think is fair.
Yeah.
So I can imagine that mass is probably more critical in a launch situation and with enhanced gravity. So getting in shape would prohibit someone taking up one or two seats, I would imagine, right?
Yeah, and you know, no one's going to go up this not in good enough shape to handle that kind of a heavy G takeoff. You know, we are going to have big people, but I mean, you know, basketball players are going to be going up there. Who are very tall, and seats are going to be molded to fit them and so forth.
What are they going to do when they're up there? You mentioned basketball. They're going to have some kind of microgravity sport. What do you do for 3.5 days or 4 days?
Well, we have a couple of modules that are dedicated towards entertainment. One of the things is you can, of course, go for the spacewalk, too. You can go outside, and you can go out on the rim and watch the Earth in rotation and so forth. There's module 25, which will be added later on. But initially, you're going to have these facilities called GAs, gymnasium auditoriums. And one of the first things that guests would do when they come to Von Braun Station is they're going to learn how to walk. You're now in low G. We're used to walking in one full G. And when you're in low G, you may be able to push off with the same amount of strength, but, you know, you're going to be kind of moving in a different direction. So your first day, you just have fun at the GA, kind of learning how to walk. And then as you kind of get that down, now you're going to have fun just with the low gravity, because you can jump 6 feet in the air now. So, you know, it's going to be a very enjoyable experience in the GA for people, you know, first learn how to walk, and then later on playing volleyball, playing basketball, because it's going to be so different. We think it would be much better than in comparison to a zero-gravity situation because you have people getting sick at the same time. But under low gravity, we don't think that's going to happen. But once again, this is a big experiment. We're going to find out.
So most of the time...
Also, sorry, you asked me what else people could do. That's just one thing. In the evenings, we're going to have rock bands come up there. We're going to have musicians. We're going to have artists and entertainers and so forth. So every night there's basically going to be a concert. Because dancing, you know, is another physical activity that's going to be a lot more fun, whereas older people are going to feel young again, and young people are going to feel like Spider-Man. So you're going to have a lot of fun just with the low gravity, and that's really what this is all about, your first taste of space. I've also been told that astronauts' favorite thing to do in space is just to look out the window. Well, we're going to have huge windows in this place, as big as we can possibly build them with seven-layer borosilicate glass, or maybe the new Elon, the aluminum... clear aluminum and so forth. So, you know, we're going to, no one's going to be bored at this station. You also have the restaurant bar and so forth, where you're going to have a, you know, little ceremony, going away ceremonies and presentation ceremonies and so forth. But, you know, with a crew of 112 people and only 288 guests, you know, you're going to be rubbing shoulders with rock stars, with actors and so forth. It's going to be a very unique experience.
Maybe. I mean, who knows what that unique experience is going to be, right?
A very enjoyable experience.
It could be truly wild. Ben, you'll love this question. Ben is in New Orleans, and he said, listening to you, this sounds like this is a singles Club Med weekend, but in space. Can you comment on that?
Someone asked me how many people are going to be joining the 300 Mile High Club, and I don't know. That's a personal choice. And it may be, you know, that there's going to be a lot of singles there. We don't know the matrix of people that we're going to have going up there. I've never been to Club Med either, so I don't really know exactly what that's like, but I can kind of imagine what it's like. I think people are going to be having a lot of fun there. While they're there, and it's going to be, you know, a unique experience that's unmatched from anything down here. And for some people, not everyone, but some people who want to have a career in space, this is the beginning. You know, they're going to go up there, and they're going to choose the extra options where they're actually using a real space suit when they go out for that spacewalk. And as the crew gets to know them, you know, they may be invited to become crew down the line. And for the people who are crew, remember, think about the resume they're going to have when they do this. When they start hiring people for moon bases to go to Mars, you know, here's the kind of person you want to hire. Someone who knows how to run an airlock. Someone who knows how to handle a rapid depressurization. This kind of thing is a start for all kinds of people in careers in space.
Okay, I got another question for you, listeners. I know we're coming up on the end of our hour, but if you...
I can extend if you want.
Yeah, if you want to get a call in... try it. Do it. 1-866-687-7223. Another email, drspace@thespaceshow.com. Ralph is in Atlanta, and he says, I'm older. I've been on cruises, and one of the initial things they do on a cruise is put you through some sort of a lifeboat drill, life jacket drill, things of that nature, sort of like the little lecture you get when the airplane is about to take off on how to use the emergency exits and a vest if you're going to be flying over water. Do you expect to have some sort of cruise ship sort of protocol for emergencies? This is what you're going to do. This is how you do it. This is your station you run to, on and on and on.
Good question, Ralph. And yes, exactly. The cruise ship we use as a model in many situations for Von Braun Station. Before you ever go up there, everyone is going to go through a lot of training.
On the ground.
Ground training.
Uh-huh.
How to handle certain equipment, how to handle both the emergency equipment. I mean, we do this little thing on the airplane where you're told, you know, stay in your seat and pull down the oxygen mask if they drop and so forth.
Well,
This is much more extensive than that. You can have a rapid depressurization on Von Braun Station in many different places, and your reaction has to be different. So there's going to be a lot of training involved. For instance, if you have a rapid D inside of an access tube, you know, you're not just, you know, you're basically going to run in one direction that these giant arrows appear on the sides of the walls telling you to go. As these inflatable seals begin to seal off that portion, if you somehow got trapped in that portion, from the walls, you're going to see emerging these emergency vacuum chambers that are inflatable spheres that you crawl into, and where you would stay until the crew could patch it up or basically drag that sphere out to back into a pressurized area. So there's a lot of training that's going to go into our guests before they go up there. They're going to know how to handle many situations. And one of them, of course, is going to be boarding an ERV in case a very horrible catastrophic event somehow, tore the station apart where it's no longer usable and people had to go down, just like you see on a cruise ship where everyone gets on board their life rafts and lifeboats and so forth. You'd be trained for that too.
So we saw that concept in a James Bond movie where when the space stations were breaking up, there were all sorts of portable evacuation chambers around the hallways of the station that you could get into and be jettisoned back to Earth.
Exactly.
I don't know if you remember that, James Bond.
There's a lot of possibilities which could have a catastrophic event on board Von Braun Station to where we would have to evacuate the station. And that's what those ERVs are for. We have to look at every possibility and give as many options for people to, escape healthy and alive, in case one of these events did occur.
So here's a question for you from another listener. This is Phil, and Phil's in Nashville. And he's asking a question you were going to comment on when we had our phone line test the other night, but it hasn't come up yet, but somebody's actually asking you this question. Phil in Nashville says, I'm curious why you're using the name Von Braun for this space station. I understand his contribution to the American space program, but he also had a contribution as our enemy in World War II, and he was an SS officer. Why honor him with naming the space station after him?
That's a good question, too.
And you were going to tell us this when we talked to you about the phone test, but I forgot to bring it up. But Phil in Nashville is, I guess, on your wavelength. So go for it. Why Von Braun?
Wernher von Braun, his dream was to build rockets that take people to the moon and beyond, to Mars and to Jupiter and so forth. That was his dream before the Nazis even came to power. And when they did come to power, he was just graduating from university with his doctorate. And what they did, what the Nazis did, was they shut down all the rocket clubs. And that's what von Braun was very active in. He had a big group of friends and associates. He was building rockets, and it was all shut down. His only option to build rockets at that point was to work for the government. And so he did. And for 1934, 35, 36, 37, he was working for the government, but he didn't join the Nazi Party then. And that's a big statement. There's only one party. And they shut down the newspapers, and then the Nazis were just, he knew they were not nice people. They had the book burnings going on. He didn't want to be a part of the group, but he had to. He had to work for them if he wanted to develop rockets. There was no option anymore. And then the war started. And we all know how bad things got during the war. It was a nightmare for him, who wanted to build rockets for friendly reasons, and here he is developing rockets, working for the most detested person, throughout the war, Heinrich Himmler, the Darth Vader of the day. He had no choices then. They even suspected him once just because he was talking with his brother in a negative manner about the war, just questioning the things they were doing in the war, what was going on. And they threw him in jail for 2 weeks and didn't even tell him why. It was a horrible situation, and he had no choices. But when he did have a choice, when he finally had a chance to run, he ran. Him and the other scientists, they all ran and came over to the Allies. It gets worse for him. He comes to America, and many of us on this program are Americans. We think this is a great country, but he was forced to do the same thing. He had to build rockets for a nation at war again, the Cold War. And once again, this is not his dream. He was trapped, making ICBMs of far more destructive power than in Germany. But here he had a way out. It's the First Amendment, the freedom of speech, and he used it with Collier's magazine to put out the images of what space travel could be like for people. And when Walt Disney saw that, he made movies. He got together with Von Braun. They made movies about, peaceful space travel, non-military expeditions to the moon and so forth. And it caught the attention of Eisenhower. And Eisenhower made this movie required watching at the Pentagon. And that's when NASA started. And finally, Von Braun was able to achieve his dream of building rockets for peaceful programs, which was the Saturn V, and taking people to the moon. And an extraordinary life that he had with extraordinary results because he stuck to his dream. And, think about building rockets in the 40s or the 50s. I mean, people say right now building a space station is impossible. Well, he didn't think so. You know, he had models for it. It was all his plan. His plan. Von Braun Station is modeled after basically his plan. And I hope that his plan goes forward of people having bases on the moon and going to Mars and going beyond out to Saturn and Jupiter and so forth. So we had to honor him with that. We had to say that, you know, of all the people who had plans, he had a lot of success because he stuck with it. That's kind of our motto. We're going to stick with it, too. So we believe he deserves the name for the station. Now, it's not just we, the company. We had a vote of all the people in our membership, and they overwhelmingly chose Wernher von Braun or von Braun Station as the name of the station.
For investors, is this an accredited investor thing? Is it a Kickstarter-like equity investment? How are you doing the investment program? You said traditional, but what does that mean in today's world?
We're looking for VC investors to come in from the start. But
okay.
Orbital Assembly, which is what we just incorporated, which we're going to utilize to build the space construction tools to mix space stations and spaceports, that is a C Corp. And we want to sell stock to people. That's what we really want to do. We want people to be able to invest in a space program that we never could, like at NASA, in Orbital Assembly and the mechanisms and the systems that we're going to use to build this extraordinary future for humankind in space. So, yes, we're going to start off with traditional investment from VC capital and so forth. But we're down the line, it's going to be something that people could just buy stock in like they would anything else.
No plans for a Kickstarter equity program anytime soon.
We might have another Kickstarter. The real reason would be to gain attention. We want people to see this program for what it can do, to bring in more traditional investors. We don't really want to have small-time investors. We want banks to look down the road and see, you know, wow, this is the next real estate. I mean, they're making a building right now in New York that's going to cost $2 billion. So, you know, when you look at the price tag of this space station that's actually in some ways simpler to build, remote location, difficult things, but actually come together rather quickly because the components are made down here. This is going to become what we want investors to see as another traditional investment. We want them to look at the numbers and say, yeah, this works. And that's why we're doing these economic models for the station. That's why we're using simple systems and easy components to put together.
John, we're past the 60 minutes. What have we missed? What did you want to talk about? What should we have talked about? What do you want to say, or what do you want to leave with our listeners thinking about?
Yeah, for those who are listening, for those of us, and if you're listening to the show, you're a space enthusiast. You want, really, you don't worry. I mean, it's exciting to see launches where we're launching satellites and so forth, but that's not what we dreamed of when we were kids. We all dreamed of going into space in our lifetime. This is the start of that. This is where it begins, where people start going up into space to work. You know, large numbers of people, not just a few at a time. I want you to realize that the space construction industry, which is forming right now, and the spaceports that are going to be built in your lifetime, not 30 years later, we're talking 10 years later, this is where the golden age of space travel is really going to begin, because it's personal now. You have a chance to go. You have a chance to work in space. And the number of people working in space and going to space is going to be extraordinary. And it's going to happen very fast. So I'm telling you, it's okay to be excited. You know, it's finally starting to happen.
We will stay in touch with you and keep checking in to see how you're doing. Do you publish a newsletter or send out newsletter updates or anything like that that people can subscribe to?
We've been trying to get a regular newsletter going. The thing is, we're mostly engineers, and we've been working on design and how to build things and so forth. And we need someone who can do social media. I'm an old pilot, you know, that's not my thing either. So we're hiring a lot of people right now. Of course, we're hiring more engineers because we're building space construction machines. So we're not good at this, but we're working on this. We're going to get a newsletter going. We're going to have regular updates on what's going on and so forth. That's one of our goals. So yes, you can expect that.
So I have one more kind of contrarian question that just came in. You want
Sure.
to stay and take it?
Sure, of course.
I don't know if you're going to like this one or not.
Really?
let's see. So this is in Doug, and he's in Wichita, Kansas. And he said, I noticed when David introduced you, he mentioned a lot about Boeing, either you're flying Boeing airplanes or you were a Boeing instructor or a part of their program or something of that nature. Boeing lately has really screwed up with the MAX jet, and they have great engineers, and yet they really screwed up big time. How do we, as potential passengers and investors, trust or do due diligence or verify that you guys as engineers aren't going to screw up? Engineers screw up, and screwing up in space doesn't allow you much freedom or room for an error. Screwing up with a commercial space transportation jet may allow you to get back down to the ground, but that didn't happen with the two MAX crashes. So I'm concerned. How can people do due diligence on your engineering designs and your competency to do what you're talking about and keep it safe?
That's a good question, Doug. And things are moving fast right now, and you have reason to have concerns about the way the space industry is moving into space and starting to prepare to take lots of tourists into space. And as a person in aviation, which you reference here in your question, I want to start with by saying that you're never safe when you go off the ground, whether you're in a 737 or you're going into space on board a Starship. You're never really going to be safe. You're taking a chance. I've had very few mishaps in aviation. I only lost engine and aircraft twice. But, yeah, it happens. And we train for it. We prepare for it. And we haven't had a lot of deaths in space compared to aviation because, you know, NASA is very, very safety-oriented. So if you're looking for something to be completely safe, I can't guarantee you that you're going to be safe whenever you leave the ground. Whether you're going into the air or you're going to space, there's going to be a certain amount of risk you're just going to have to accept. Of course, we're going to do everything we can, and if you look at Von Braun Station's design, there are numerous safety systems accounting for many different types of mishaps, whether it be a rapid depressurization, whether it be a medical emergency of some kind where we have to get someone down. There's a lot built into this, and there's going to be a lot more coming because we're hiring more engineers, looking at more systems and how the doors function in certain situations where you might have a catastrophe going on, and how the crews are going to be trained, and there's going to be a lot to it. And just like Apollo program, we can't think of everything. So we can only do the best we can.
Is there an organization, a group, something that people could look to that we look to FAA that the plane is safe, right? And we look to FAA to know that, look, if you're a stew or a hostess on any of these planes, you can get the passengers off in, 90 seconds or something like that?
Right, exactly.
You know, if the plane comes down somewhat intact, if it's all on fire, you know, good luck. Is there some agency, organization, or something where the designs and your systems for safety and EVAC and this and that and the other have met some objective standard where people can be comfortable that there's been oversight, or are they dependent in this early stage of industry development on your company oversight, and that's it?
You know, it's a really good question because we made a video a while back talking about this, how when you look at the aviation regulations, which I'm very familiar with, it's this huge, thick book. It's like 1,600 pages. But the regulations that NASA just came out with for what they call spaceflight participants, they don't even call them tourists yet.
Right, I know that. Yeah.
It's like 20 pages long or 6 pages long or something. That's a joke. But NASA is the best organization when it comes to safety, as far as I know, when it comes to any kind of spaceflight. And we've already invited them in to look at our design. The last two videos and the next one coming out really soon, design challenges videos for Von Braun Station, they invite NASA engineers and NASA people to tell us, is this a good design? Is the time right? And we go through a somewhat detailed description of how the systems were all designed, which systems we're using. Is it the Honeywell carbon dioxide reduction unit here? Is it going to be how the solar panels work, and you know what kind of voltage we're pulling out of the electrical system? We list on our videos also the entire bus diagram for the electrical system. I mean, there's a lot of detail that's already gone into the station, and we're inviting NASA engineers and people to look at this and tell us what they think. Tell us where we think we can improve this and so forth. So there's still a long ways to go in the design of the station, and it's going to be as safe as we can possibly make it, because it's going to be for space tourists who are not astronauts. We don't have the same level of training, and it has to be safe enough for them to go in.
You know, I have this book, and I've talked about it on the Space Show, but not recently. And it was I've had it for about 10 years, and it was on after the Christmas season sale at Barnes & Noble on the Let's Get Rid of This Stuff cheap for $1. And I forget the name of the author, but it is titled The 100 Worst Airplanes Ever Made. And you go, I've read every page of it 20 times. And I mean, you've got famous companies, German companies, UK companies, American, Italian, you know, it's the history of aviation. And they're all engineers, and they're all building these planes. And they're either horrible because the designs don't work and they crash and kill people, or they're horrible because economically they couldn't earn a dime in revenue and they folded. The Convair, for example, you know, the 880 and the 980. The first jet that had the large windows that kept crashing because they didn't realize that those windows would break apart. And it was a British plane, I forget. But there's many, many others that just have really crappy designs or bad engineering. So I think people, just for the record, people do have a concern that the engineering is going to be sound. You're probably too young, but you remember the gas tanks blowing up in what was the Ford car that happened, and the Corvair that was unsafe, and the Firestone tires that were defective, and I think it was Ford wouldn't change them. So this stuff happens, and people want to know that engineering and design are competent. And long, long time ago, when sort of the Musk was starting out and others were starting out, and the XPRIZE was a hot topic, I was at a National Space Society keynote luncheon in Los Angeles, and the guy who built the XPRIZE plane, I forget his name, can't believe I'm having a senior moment and I'm forgetting his name. He gave the keynote address. He retired and went to Idaho. Okay, so people know who I'm talking about.
I know who you mean, yeah.
And he there was a whole big discussion going on about safety and regulation and on and on and on. And he said, you know, no matter what you say, if you want to be commercial and have this industry generate revenues, people are going to have to feel as safe and comfortable getting into a rocket ship to go to space as they are in getting onto a jet airplane to fly from Los Angeles to New York. And we're not there yet, and the industry can't afford to turn a deaf ear to that simple fact.
That's true.
And Burt Rutan. And,
yeah, Burt Rutan, yeah.
Yeah, nice. And I think it's true, and so you know, the question from the listener is right along that line. Just because you've got great engineers with great track records doesn't necessarily mean your design is great or safe or economic.
Yeah. Well, our design is great. That's right.
Well, I'm just throwing it out there.
You know, we can't anticipate everything. We can just do our best. And of course, that's what we're going to do. But the design is traditional, and we're not trying any new technologies for that reason. Each one of those jets that you mentioned there, they were new designs. And new design means you're trying something new. We're not trying to try anything new here. A lot of the stuff is using existing systems, using existing materials that have been used before. That said, of course, no one's ever made a rotating space station before. So there is going to be a learning curve. We don't know what all that's going to be, but you know, we're going to do the best that we can. And the people who go up to the station, at least for the first year or so, they're going to be warned. You know, this is not as safe as flying an airplane. It's just as safe as we can possibly make it. Because if there's something that we can imagine that could bring harm to a crew member or a guest, we're going to try to address that to the best that we can. There's just too much at stake here. Billions of dollars for investors and the lives of family members and loved ones. And, you know, if you have a disaster that could be foreseen or something like that, it would just set everything back too much. So that's why when you look at the design challenges videos that we made, you see us going through numerous systems, safety systems for people, and there may be more coming. So.
Interesting. Well, we're going to follow you very closely, and we will continue to look for more reports from you, and I hope we can invite you to back down on the show when you have some new things that you'd like to share with us or talk to us about. Let me know, and we'll bring you back on the air.
I look forward to that.
And we look forward to it. And best of luck, and we will rest assured that the space show and the audience will stay abreast of your development. So we're looking out for it, and hopefully you're successful, and we'll applaud, and I want to do a space show from someone up there. So
yeah, that'd be great.
Hopefully they'll have the bandwidth to do a good discussion with some of your crew members or some of the fun people up there, or maybe even some of the construction crew when they're off duty. That also would be fun.
That's a good idea.
I'm all in. So, John, thank you very much for being a guest on the Space Show. And listeners, thank you for phone calls and for emails. And back Tuesday, tomorrow evening, for our regular Tuesday evening Space Show program. Everybody have a great week, and keep looking up. Good night from John David and the Space Show.